It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. Already, pundits are mulling over the 2016 presidential race. Now, this is just a few months after the midterm elections. There is a common perception that the president drives the agenda of the nation and truly makes things happen. But really, an argument can be made that Congress is in some ways more important than the president for driving legislative action. And lately, the president and Congress have not been getting along so well. Bipartisanship seems to be a thing of the past, and a divided government seems to be almost assured for all but very short periods of time. Political scientist Thomas Schaller has written about how the House and the Senate have changed in a new book. It's called The Stronghold: How Republicans Captured Congress but Surrendered the White House. And we welcome Thomas Schaller to the show. Thomas, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Steve.
Often we hear people lament how big things can't get done. Some people assert that to make American government really do things, it requires a party majority, like Lyndon Johnson had in the first part of his administration. Obama had that advantage for his first 2 years. So would you agree that partisanship equals gridlock?
Yeah, I mean, we've had a lot of gridlock, too, by that definition, because the country's been divided about 70% of the last 60 years. And I don't know, some people would make the argument that some of our more productive governments happened when they were divided. Certainly Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich both take their share of credit for the reduction in budget deficits in the 1990s, and they probably are both half right and half wrong in the credit that they take for it. But I think in general, we see gridlock when we see the government divided against itself by the parties. And I always find it interesting, that particularly for people who venerate the Constitution, because the Founding Fathers put checks and balances in the government between the Congress and the presidency, not thinking that they would need this additional partisan check. But the voters really like divided government, as poll after poll shows, especially independents and moderates who are in the middle, and they usually decide these elections, and so they really seem to be wary of putting any one party in control of everything. I think the downside of that, just speaking personally, is you never really know who did it. I mean, I think by 2006, you could blame the Republicans for the management of the war and maybe the management of the economy. They had run the government, and if you were unhappy with Obamacare and cap and trade, you clearly could blame the Democrats in 2010. But a lot of the time, because the power is separated between the two parties, there's a lot of finger-pointing, and probably both parties are equally guilty and equally right in blaming the other.
Your book focuses on the post-Reagan Republican Party, but you assert that Newt Gingrich, not Reagan, is probably the most significant figure in the Republican Party since Nixon.
I do, and I think that's because of the style of politics that Newt Gingrich brought in. You know, Reagan was famous for being able to work along with Tip O'Neill and the Democrats in Congress. Even though Reagan had the Senate for the first 6 years, he really could have bullied them around quite a bit. But I think that style of cooperative politics between the two parties has disappeared. Now, it's not entirely Gingrich's fault. The country has become more polarized, and we've lost our moderates. There just are no real conservative Democrats left in, say, the Senate or the House, and there's not any moderate or liberal Republicans left in the Senate and the House. There used to be a significant overlap between, say, the most liberal Republican senator and the most conservative Democratic senator, but that doesn't exist anymore. The parties are really two distinct coalitions that have the gap between them that grows and grows each year. So I think as we've taken away, say, Southern Democrats and replaced them with Republicans and taken Northeastern and Midwestern Republicans and replaced them with Democrats over the last 30 or 40 years, there's not a lot of ideological overlap between the two parties. And so Gingrich brought this style of politics, this more combative style of politics to the House. Clearly he and Dick Armey and others, Tom DeLay, really went after not only their fellow Republicans in the House, they went after George W. H.W. Bush, Dick Armey famously publishing a critique of the Bush budget deal that Dick Darman and others negotiated with the Democrats in Congress. And I think this new style of politics where you always side with your side and you never negotiate and you vote no on everything for the other party's agenda is our sort of new normal here.
Does the strategy of running against, say, the sitting president for both parties, the Democrats running against Bush and the Republicans now running against Obama, does that strategy produce more extremes and produce a party that might be more likely to win dozens of House races but not necessarily the presidency?
I think it does, and I think we saw that in both 2010 and 2014 with respect to the Republicans. I mean, you have the sort of soothsayers in Washington who always talk about the need to demonstrate that you can govern and that you're a responsible party, but in the last 4 years, when the Republicans just had the House under Boehner, we had a government shutdown, we had a couple of debt ceiling, hostage-taking moments where the Republicans were threatening to hold the full faith and credit of the United States Treasury hostage to their demands in the congressional negotiations, and people said, well, the Republicans are going to pay for this. People look at them as using their powers to blow up the government, and they're the party of no, and they don't really want to do anything. They just want to stop Obama's agenda. They voted against Obamacare to partially or wholly repeal it 54 times, even though they knew they didn't have the votes in the Senate, so this was mostly symbolic politics. So they're going to be penalized at the electoral box. Well, no. I mean, that's not what happened, right? They won the House back in 2010. They continued that style of politics since 2010 under Boehner and the new sort of Tea Party movement in the House, and they won the Senate back in 2014. Probably should have won it in 2012. So the clear message there is that the politics of obstruction is not only not penalized, it can often be rewarded. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to say that that wasn't good political strategy. Now, whether it's good for the Republican Party's broader message and their branding, whether it's good for the country, those are different questions. But it was clearly good for the party from an electoral standpoint and a political standpoint.
But will it be good in a general election, a nationwide election? That's something I think gets into the actual workings of how we got to this point with what makes the environment fruitful for primary elections in particular to go right or left.
Right. No, that's a great question, Steve, because, and that's a big argument in the book, which is that that which works for the Republicans in the congressional level, and especially on the House level, may not translate to presidential politics. So there are plenty of examples, but just to take one, in 2012, you have a guy, Todd Akin. He's a House member, a typical House member, very conservative in his positions, represented a conservative district that's highly gerrymandered. He's popular with his home district. He starts talking about forcible rape, and suddenly it becomes a controversy in the Senate race that he's running for in Missouri, which he loses to Claire McCaskill, but it becomes a national story, and you think, oh my God, this is just one isolated radical Republican. Well, no, not really. The forcible rape amendment that came up in the House bill as an amendment was voted on by, say, Paul Ryan, who becomes their party's presidential, vice presidential nominee, that very cycle. And so suddenly it becomes a national controversy. Republicans are scrambling to either distance themselves or denounce Todd Akin. You've got the party leaders, you've got the presidential candidates being asked by the media, how do you feel about Akin? Do you agree, you disagree? And that's a problem when you have Mitt Romney being asked about that, because if he says Todd Akin is an idiot, he's a problem for our party, he's going to lose some of the base voters who say, geez, you know, we agree with him on abortion. And if he says, well, I support him wholeheartedly, he's got a media storm on his hands. And so what works in congressional races and what works in congressional politics, particularly in the primaries, as you point out, when you really just have to win over conservative Republicans to get nominated because you win in a safe district every time, there's no real Democratic challenger in a highly gerrymandered district or a heavily Republican state in a Senate race, that stuff works in the primary and the general election to win your House or Senate seat, but it's not going to help your presidential party's nominee. And so this is the problem that the Republicans, by their own account, when they did their post-2012 governing opportunity project diagnostic, they said, our federal wing is a problem. We need to turn to governors and state leaders for our ideas and for our momentum. That's their own self-diagnostic.
You mentioned gerrymandering. Your assertion is that in politics, there are no moderates, but I would suggest that is that there are moderates, and the moderates might even be in the majority in the general populace, but the way that the districts have been redrawn is so people on the extremes can win elections and that the parties can maintain power, and that sort of takes out the middle. So would you agree with that, first of all, that the general populace probably has more moderates than are represented?
Yeah, and I think you're right about the gerrymandering process. I mean, the majority party in the United States by self-description is no party, right? Is independent. About 40% of Americans don't identify with either party, and yet 98% of our members of Congress are either Republicans or Democrats, and the couple who aren't are independents who basically caucus with the Democrats like Bernie Sanders. So how is it that we have this situation? And a large part, it's because we have single-member districts with plurality rule for House and Senate elections, in every case except for, you know, Louisiana and Georgia, which have those jungle primaries and the runoff elections. And then, of course, you add on that, at least on the House side, you can't gerrymander the Senate, of course, because the districts are the states. But on the House side, both parties have a sort of duopoly where they conspire in the states that they control to draw districts that are very favorable to their own party's chances. And so moderates don't have enough voices in these primaries or even the general elections to elect moderates to Congress. And that's why we don't have any moderates in Congress. I mean, it's really remarkable how we have every vote cast by Congress from 1789, the first Congress, to the last Congress. Political scientists Poole and Rosenthal have tracked this for more than 200 years, and by every empirical standard, we have the most polarized votes in the history of the Congress over the last 20 or 30 years, and it's because of who's getting elected. And I don't see it changing anytime soon because both parties have an interest in practicing very strategic gerrymandering. And as we saw, the Republicans did a brilliant job in winning all those state governor's races and state legislative races in 2010 so they could control the map drawing in 2011 so that they could dominate in the congressional House elections of 2012. And they did.
Well, tell us about how that happened, because it might be benefiting the Republicans now, but maybe ironically, it was a bipartisan effort to redraw these districts in a way that sort of defies logic if you look at a map and benefits people at the extremes.
No, that's exactly right. And it's not just always Republicans. It is Republicans in the states that they control. But in Maryland, there's a heavily gerrymandered eight districts in Maryland where I teach, and the Democrats aren't really supported by 7/8 of the state, but they have 7 of the 8 House districts because they control the districting here. And so the problem is moderates and independents feel disaffected by both parties. And I think for the Republicans, because the Republicans at present are dominating Congress, this tends to isolate the party, because the views of a handful of conservative voters in the primaries, who are therefore determining the members of Congress, because really who wins the primary wins the general election, since the seat is drawn favorably to whoever is the Republican nominee or whoever is the Democratic nominee. Because Republicans have a very, very conservative set of people getting nominated, that party doesn't necessarily represent even the full breadth of the Republican Party, no less the full breadth of attitudes among the entire public. So one of the things I point out in the book is that Republicans are overrepresented in the House because of gerrymandering, and they're overrepresented in the Senate because over the last 30 or 40 years, they've dominated the small state elections, Idaho, Wyoming, Alaska, places like that. And so the Democrats win in California and New York and get 4 Senate seats, but the Republicans win Idaho and Wyoming and get 4 Senate seats. And so the Republicans say, hey, we've got 53% of the senators. Our positions must be popular with the majority of the country, but not necessarily. And as I show in the book, like, the Republican share of the electorate has always been lower than their share of seats in the Senate, whether they're in the majority or minority. And so they go to Washington, they say, hey, we're winning these elections. We're controlling House and Senate. Our agenda must be popular, but it's sort of they're getting sort of a false echoing effect from the electorate because their power is essentially inflated by gerrymandering in the House and the small Senate seat advantage in the Senate.
Is there any historical precedent then to say, well, if this is set up to be divisive, if it's set up to cater to the ideological concerns of the most extreme, that nothing's going to get done? For instance, Obamacare is a great example. It seems like a huge majority of Republicans ran their individual races saying, we're going to repeal Obamacare. It's not likely to happen as long as Obama is the president and can veto whatever they bring through, or if there is another Democrat that can do the same thing. Historically, does the populace say, oh, well, we're electing these guys, but nothing ever really gets done, so it doesn't address our anger?
Well, I think this is a big problem because people keep saying, and I, to be honest with you, I kind of blame the voters a little bit. They vote for divided government, and then they expect the two parties to work together. It's not necessarily the voters' fault that the two parties are isolated ideologically for the reasons we just discussed, and that the Republicans have moved farther right at the same time the Democrats have moved farther left. But they keep sending a sort of message to incumbent presidents, whether they sent it to Bush in 2006 by giving the Democrats to Congress, or whether they sent it here in 2010 and 2014 to Obama by giving the Republicans first the House and then the Senate. But they keep dividing the government and then sitting back and expecting that government produce outcomes when the two parties really don't agree on much and have no incentive to work with each other, as I just pointed out earlier, because there's a political gain to be made by just being obstructionist for either party. And so I think we are going to continue to have gridlock. I think we're going to continue to have a dysfunctional government. I think we're going to continue to have national problems of great importance not solved because both parties basically play, you know, a sort of game of chicken. In fact, if you read what Mitch McConnell and John McCain said at the start of this new Congress just 2 weeks ago. They said very plainly and on the record, our job over the next 2 years is not to do any damage with our congressional behavior to our presidential party's chances. They're basically saying our job is not to really accomplish or achieve anything or pass laws or solve national problems. Our job is to basically do no harm to the party so that we can win the White House in 2016. And you basically have Obama in his State of the Union saying, okay, if you guys are going to put Keystone Pipeline and these other things up to make the Democrats look bad and Hillary Clinton maybe put her in a bad position, I'm going to turn around and do the same thing. I'm going to put a bunch of things on the agenda and make you as a Congress vote down middle-class tax cuts, because it's, even though they're not going to pass, because it's not really about passing things or changing the law. It's about one party trying to show up the other party in order to win the next election. And that's a really, really dysfunctional democracy.
And maybe that's why we always see governors elected as president instead of somebody that comes out of Congress.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, you have members of Congress like saying now, Republicans saying, we shouldn't nominate anybody who hasn't served as a governor. In fact, that's a big recommendation of that Governing Opportunity Project, is that nominating House or Senate members who've never served as a governor, or never run even a city as a mayor, say, don't really have any governing experience, and it's better to take a really quality, successful governor and run that person for the White House. You know, Obama's the first senator to win the presidency since Kennedy, and Kennedy was the first senator, sitting senator, to win the presidency since Harding. So U.S. senators usually don't win presidential elections. Obviously, McCain, if he had beaten Obama, would have been a senator too. So we were going to have a senator get elected president in 2008 either way. But governors, Carter, Bush, Reagan, obviously Clinton, were all governors coming in, and I think the Republicans will probably nominate a governor or a former governor, Chris Christie or Jeb Bush, somebody like that. But, as I point out in the book, Romney, a former governor, was the nominee in 2012. He got about 25% of the vote in the Iowa caucus, the first voting moment of the 2012 primary cycle. But the House candidates, Gingrich, Bachman, Ron Paul, and Santorum, got 64% of the vote in the Iowa. So the voters in Iowa, the rank-and-file Republicans, were really voting for the congressional wing in Iowa, not for the sort of gubernatorial wing. In 2012, Romney eventually won, but they have to be careful. I think they would be smart, the Republicans, to nominate a governor.
Thomas Schaller's book, The Stronghold, How Republicans Captured Congress But Surrendered the White House, covers all these issues. Thomas, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great to be here. Thanks, Steve.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back after this. It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC.